Hello again, everyone. The interviews this time cover two entirely different subjects that I think you will find very interesting. First, I talk with Paul Kettle, formerly chairman of psychiatry at Hershey and now a member of our medical staff. You may recall my conversation with Paul in our summer 2007 issue, which was volume 2, number 2. If you didn't hear it then, and you don't have the disc anymore, you can go to our website, jlgh.org, where all our interviews are archived as MP3 files. On this disc, I'm going to talk with Paul about mental health among physicians, including depression, substance abuse, and suicide. Sadly, these problems are common. Next, I talk with John May and Alistair Grant, founders and namesakes of May Grant Associates, a leading OBGYN practice in Lancaster for 4 decades. We talk about the changes in how obstetrical services have been delivered and the social context for these changes. John and Alistair have been true pioneers in delivering these services, and I encourage you to hear their story. We have the pleasure once again of welcoming Paul Kettle to our microphone. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
We interviewed Paul, a psychiatrist here on staff, some months ago on the subject of depression, and that was an interview that generated a great deal of positive feedback. Today, we're going to ask Paul to reprise a presentation that he gave at a recent medical staff meeting on subjects of physicians' mental health. Of course, some of us think all doctors are a little bit crazy, but this is a more serious approach to the problem. So let me ask you right at the outset, Paul, are doctors healthy?
It depends. Physically, doctors are healthier than the general population, and their mental health, unfortunately, is not as good, meaning that doctors have more trouble with depression and more trouble with substance abuse. And that's pretty much the bottom line. Physically, though, they do quite well, that their death rates are much, much lower than that of the general population. And it's thought that that's because of mainly two factors. One is that doctors don't smoke, for the most part, and so they don't have the smoking-related fatalities that unfortunately are seen commonly in the general population. And the other thing is that it may well be that doctors are healthier to begin with, that is, to be able to get through medical school and internship and residency, you have to have some stamina, shall we put it politely, and so maybe healthier to begin with.
Well, that's certainly nice to hear. But in terms of mental health, my impression is that the picture isn't quite the same.
Right, that unfortunately doctors have higher rates of depression and suicide. And that, as far as we can tell, begins really very early on. In training, for example, if you look at depression rates in medical students and residents, that they're higher than the general population. One study showed that they were 15% to 30% higher than the general population. And unfortunately, rates of depression in physicians are probably higher than the general population as well. Even if you follow that out to fatal aspects of depression, that is suicide, that unfortunately suicide rates are higher. Male physicians have suicide rates that are 40% higher than the general population. Female physicians have suicide rates more than double that of the general population. So unfortunately, it's a big, big problem.
Why do you think suicide is even more common among female physicians than among male physicians?
Well, that's not clear. There are different ideas about that. One idea is that, in general, in the U.S. population, suicide attempts are much more common in females than in males, and it may well be that female physicians are simply better at killing themselves. That is, they know more pharmacology, they know more anatomy. And so it may well be that they're simply more successful at their attempt. But other people wonder if there may be social factors as well, that female physicians, at least in the birth cohorts that we're looking at, may be more isolated, may be under more stress to try to balance work and family lives, and so suicide may be a result of that as well.
Is there some special category of physicians that are more prone to depression and suicide? I'm, of course, thinking of psychiatrists, for example.
Right. Well, I think psychiatrists are special, and thank you for pointing it out. But psychiatrists do have higher mortality rates, both in suicide as well as depression. And reasons for that are also not clear. Some people wonder if it's because of the work of psychiatrists that is listening to these problems all day. Some people wonder if it's that some psychiatrists may choose the profession because they have mental health problems and may be choosing that as a way of working through it. But for whatever reason, psychiatrists do have higher rates of depression and suicide.
Are there other categories of physicians that you can single out the way you can single out psychiatrists?
Substance abuse, unfortunately, is more common in psychiatrists, but also more common in anesthesiologists, best we can tell. And again, whether it's because of the work or whether or not anesthesiologists may be attracted to work that would deal with drugs and may have more interest in drug abuse.
And there's also opportunity. I mean, they have the stuff available to them all the time.
Right, the temptation is there constantly. And so anesthesiologists seem to have higher rates of substance abuse than other specialties.
It's not something I would have thought of, but again, you're bringing things up that many of us don't really ever think of. Now, since we've mentioned the subject of substance abuse, how big a problem is that, and how do people get started down that unfortunate path?
Well, it is a big problem. Of course, it's impossible to practice medicine and not know it's a big problem in the general population. Among physicians, we generally don't think of it as a problem, but unfortunately, it can be a big problem. In physicians, though, it's eminently treatable, as I guess we'll get to in a moment. But it probably does begin at an earlier age. We know that substance abuse in general tends to begin in teens or early adulthood. And clearly there are some physicians who have substance abuse problems and then are able to keep it under control long enough to get through medical school, and that simply continues. But unfortunately, substance abuse can develop during training as a way of dealing with the stressors of training and the problem with fatigue or problems with overwhelming stress. One study, for example, showed that about 9.5% of residents, for example, had used benzodiazepines that they'd either taken from samples or written for themselves.
I was going to ask you, how do residents get access to these drugs?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they have prescription pads, and so they can write for themselves and obviously shouldn't, but that can be a problem. And it may well be that they are suffering from stress, and it may well be that it's an appropriate use to begin with, but certainly unmonitored or at least not worked up effectively if they're writing it for themselves can be a problem. And that can unfortunately continue and can branch out into other things. That physicians, for example, as opposed to other doctors, are more likely to abuse opiate medications. And so if you look at substances abused by doctors, about a third are using opiates, which is, you know, a relatively high rate compared to the general population.
What about something much more mundane like alcohol?
Oh, alcohol is, of course, the most commonly abused substance, both with physicians as well as in the general population. And alcoholism and alcohol abuse, unfortunately, is more common in physicians than in the general population.
Well, I wondered about that. What are the consequences in practical terms of some of these abuses? In other words, substance abuse, for example. How often does it lead to people having to give up practice, losing their license, etc.? Do we have any data on that?
There is some data on that. The Pennsylvania State Board of Medicine has an impaired physician group, and they have been following people for the last decade or so. And they did a review of the physicians who were in their care in the early 1990s, and they found that 85% of addicted physicians were able to return to their practice, that they were either able to continue practicing with treatment or, after a relatively brief time, get back to their practice. So that's 85% of people were able to do that, and the folks think they're doing a better job now, and they think their rates are maybe 90%.
So this is 85 to 90% of substance abuse.
Substance abusing physicians are able to get back to their practice.
Yeah, not just alcohol abuse.
Right, alcohol or substance abuse, it's all together.
Yeah.
So in other words, the treatment for physicians is really remarkably good. And there are other groups, of course, that have high status, high pay positions. And airline pilots is one that gets a lot of press. But airline pilots have similar success rates. That is, treatment success rates of about 90% of being able to get back on the job. So the key thing is that if somebody has a problem with substance abuse, that they should seek treatment, because the success rate is really quite good. And the reason why it's so much better for physicians is physicians may be healthier to begin with. They often have much more support. They have the financial wherewithal to afford better treatment. And all of this, of course, means that their outcome is often better. So that's good. They, in essence, have
more to lose. Well, and they have more to lose.
So they, because they have more to lose, they are more motivated in treatment.
Well, of course, the flip side of that discussion is if one knows about someone who is substance abusing, then one would do them a favor by reporting it rather than helping them conceal it.
Right, and the question is how to do that. The first thing to do is to ask the individual, are you having a problem? Have you thought about getting treatment? And then the next thing to do would be to talk to a colleague, perhaps somebody in their practice, to put the lien on them. And the reason why it's important to lean on them is that Pennsylvania law says that you have to report people, but you only have to report if, according to the statute, there's substantial evidence of substance abuse. And we can debate what substantial evidence is, but the statute was written vaguely to encourage treatment. And also you are mandated to report only if the person is not receiving treatment. So if somebody goes to an appointment, they're receiving treatment. And so the key is to get somebody into treatment. And the Impaired Physicians Program, again, run by the state and assisted by the State Board of Medicine, is really there to help people and has decades of experience to get people in. So if somebody is in treatment, you don't have to report to the State Board of Medicine because they're involved in treatment, they're doing something about it. If somebody is refusing to admit they have a problem, refusing to say there's anything wrong, refusing to get any treatment, then that's when you have to report somebody to the State Board of Medicine, as long as there is, quote, substantial evidence, unquote.
Well, there's a very important message here, because what you're telling our audience is that being reported is not the kiss of death. You don't suddenly have your license yanked out from under you and you lose everything in life. If you're reported, it's only because you were not willing to undergo treatment, and that, in fact, the thing to do if one has a problem is to get into treatment, and the law is written in such a way that one can continue to practice under those circumstances. Am I interpreting the law correctly?
Yeah, I think that's correct, that the law really was crafted to make sure people get into treatment. And the reason for that is that the success rate for treatment among physicians, at least, is really very high. And people should get into treatment. Unfortunately, if people don't, the outcome is usually death. That is, one survey of Midwest State looked at the first 100 physicians that were referred to their impaired physician program. And they found that 73% had done very well. On a 17-year follow-up, they had done very well. And the rest had died. And the rest had died actually pretty soon, and usually as a result of their alcoholism.
Well, gee, this sounds to me like the rare example of a very wise bit of legislation. And it was more of a carrot legislation rather than a stick.
Right. And, of course, it's not just the legislation, but how it's interpreted is, of course, always important.
And how it let itself be interpreted, though, is also important.
And the State Board of Medicine also has put in place the Impaired Physician Program that has been successful and really does seek to help people out and get treatment because, this is a fatal illness often. And so if people don't get treatment, they do end up, unfortunately, dead from the results of their substance abuse.
Well, let me ask you then, how often is depression the cause of these syndromes of substance abuse.
Often that people are feeling depressed and anxious, and substance abuse is a way it's manifested. Unfortunately, sometimes it simply is substance abuse being the major problem. We know, for example, that substance abuse does have some genetic causes in and of itself, that there are some people who use substances as a way of avoiding other problems, and that could be work stresses, marital stresses, any other kind of stressors. So depression is a common problem where people use substances or alcohol, but also, of course, alcoholism, unfortunately, can occur without it as well. But either way, both ends are treatable.
What can physicians do to reduce their likelihood of getting caught up in this kind of deleterious behavior?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that all of us are involved in deleterious behavior. I'm not saying that all of us have depression or that all of us have substance abuse as a problem, but all of us certainly have problems. And all of us certainly have problems managing work life and family life. Again, that's pervasive and an occupational hazard, really, of somebody who has a high stress and high responsibility type of position. When I was looking around for ways of putting this, I came across an article in Canada. They had a focus group of physicians, and they asked physicians, really, what does work stress come from? And they came up with really a triad that they thought that work stress as a physician came from a triad of doubt, guilt, and an exaggerated sense of responsibility. In other words, if physicians are doubting themselves all the time and feel like they're never doing enough, feeling guilty about that, and feeling that they have to cure people, that they have to take care of every person, then of course they're unable to do that. That's an impossible set of expectations. And people begin feeling less good about themselves, less good about their job, and this just snowballs over time into a time when they can feel dysphoric and kind of give up. So the things to do about that are, first of all, to keep a realistic attitude about what you can do. What you should do is all you can, but you need to know what all you can do is. And so you should always strive to do all you can, but knowing what that is really key.
Now, I just have to interject that it's hard sometimes to do that when the patients are looking upon you as someone who can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat time and time and time again.
Right. The patients may come in, for example, smoking 3 packs a day, drinking too much, eating French fries at every meal, and saying, okay, can you cure me, doctor?
And help me lose 100 pounds.
Help me lose 100 pounds or whatever else. And, you know, it's important to know that we can do things to help people, but we can't run their lives. And so keeping that in perspective is important. I think it's also important to maintain some kind of perspective about what physicians can do and what physicians can really do to help people. And sometimes that's surgery, sometimes that's the beta blocker, but a lot of times it's simply being there to help people is what's important. And of course, that's what physicians have done since time began. And so that is an important part of our role in maintaining interest in that.
Unfortunately, it's becoming more and more difficult to fill that role because we don't have the time to give each patient.
Right. Kurt Vonnegut, I think, talked about the 15 minutes of fame, and that's what we give, unfortunately.
Well, it's not easy to maintain that balance, and I guess every physician has to find a level of balance that suits them between work and family life. And actually, nowadays, we're finding an increasing number of physicians who are putting more emphasis on family life. That may be reducing stress. It certainly isn't helping the manpower problem. And it's one of the reasons we have a physician shortage is because people don't work as many hours. But maybe it's going to reduce the incidence of stress-related work problems.
Well, I think you're right that whenever you squeeze one end of the balloon, the other one gets expanded. And so the key thing is making decisions for yourself that work for you, knowing that no one's going to be totally happy, that if you choose to work less, not only will your income be less, but your responsibilities at the hospital will also not be as taken care of as much by you. That is, they will have to be taken care of by somebody else. If you spend less time at home, your responsibilities there, of course, are cut as well. So knowing that you can't do everything, if you just have to make decisions about where you allocate your time, knowing that no one will be totally happy, including you. And part of the thing I think the doctors are not good at is allocating time to themselves. That is there a hobby you enjoy? Is there exercise that's helpful? Are there things you're doing to take care of your own health that's important? And doctors often don't do a good enough job of that.
Well, it's interesting how the sociological context changes, and that influences the way people look at these same problems. Certainly, one or two generations ago, the physician would often tell you that their greatest satisfaction was being at the patient's bedside. And so it wasn't stressful, it was what they wanted to do, and it gave them a great deal of satisfaction. Nowadays, I think some of that sentiment has been lost. And I think people can walk away more easily from the patient's bedside and say, I'm going to go to a soccer game right now because my kid is in a soccer game. Now, I grew up in a generation where the soccer game didn't compete. I never went to a soccer game. I didn't feel guilty about it. And I told my children, Daddy is going to be at the hospital taking care of somebody sick. And I don't think they were warped for my failure to appear at every soccer game. But I think the sociological context has just changed, and physicians have to find their own way of balancing those things. But I think that the balance is inevitably influenced by factors outside of one's own head. And that's, I guess, all that I'm trying to say.
Right. I think it's true that times have changed. The role of physicians has changed exactly in the way you say. Before my day, house staff were literally house staff. They stayed in the hospital for the entire year. And that was, of course, the way that things were. When I trained, 100-hour work weeks were not uncommon. And now, of course, there are limits on work weeks set by statute. And if you go beyond there, then your program is...
But that 80-hour work week has, in fact, created a generation of physicians who think that working more than 80 hours is absolutely not to be done. They
Right.
don't have any interest in it. And I have many more gray hairs than you do. And in my surgical internship, of course, it was a classic one, 36 hours in the hospital and 12 hours out of the hospital.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right that people today who are training are paying more attention to other things besides medicine. I mean, I think that's a good thing, but it certainly is different. The other thing is that medicine itself has changed. It used to be that physicians pretty much ran the show. And now what happens is that insurance companies have an increasing role, government has an increasing role, administration has an increasing role, and we can debate if those things are good or bad, but they certainly have changed things. And so physicians feel less in control and are less willing or able to really dictate or run things as well. So I think you're right that social things have changed, not only in families, but also in the way medicine is run. And so it is a different game altogether. I think the things that are the same are that medicine is a wonderful job, but it is a job. And that to manage that job, you have to make sure that you take care of yourself. Because it really is a marathon, and if you don't take care of yourself, you won't be able to finish.
And pace yourself, yeah. And also a theme that you touched on earlier, and that's the issue of getting help and getting help early. Because it is possible to regain your balance and to go on practicing successfully, even if you've had one of these problems.
Exactly right. That substance abuse in a physician is very treatable. Depression for everybody is very treatable. And for both of these things, you shouldn't take no for an answer. If things are not the way they should be, you need to work to make sure they are. That is either getting another practitioner, finding another AA group or whatever to go to, but making sure that you get assistance to make sure things are the way they should be.
That sounds to me like a good note on which to end. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, other than I think that it's a good topic for discussion, and certainly I'm glad the journal's taking time to devote to this because it certainly is an important part of people's lives and health.
Well, thank you very much for coming to do this for us.
Thank you.